Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Today we'll hear from two of the founding members of law enforcement against prohibition. First, from Howard Wooldridge, man who crossed America on horseback twice to talk about the need to change these prohibition laws, and from Peter Crist, a 12-year veteran of law enforcement. First up, my interview with Howard Wooldridge.
This is Howard Wooldridge, one of the founders of LEAP. And Howard, tell us about that organization, please.
Well, we were founded almost 4 years ago by five of us. We just thought there's just a few of us out there, but now after less than 4 years, we've got over 500 law enforcement members and over 5,000 friends who have joined to help us end this disastrous policy of drug prohibition.
Give us an idea who's on board.
Well, we have everything from the retired Chief Inspector Eddie Ellison, who was worked for Scotland Yard and 7 years the head of their narcotics division. We've got Chief Norm Stamper, from recently retired from the Seattle PD. We have other sheriffs. We got four sitting federal judges on our board. We just have all kinds of former City of New York police commissioner, just all professionals, mostly retired, because it's easier to shoot your mouth off when you're retired. We've come together to form a very powerful speakers bureau now with over 100 speakers. We've made over 2,000 presentations, and going to the unconverted, as we say, to give them an education. And once people see the facts, especially coming from law enforcement, we are converting people every time we go out.
And Howard, I give talks myself, but I didn't spend a lot of time in law enforcement. I worked for the Air Force, guarding nuclear weapons.
Right.
Doesn't give me the same credence as a man who's out there patrolling the streets, dealing with the criminals that many times are truly not criminals. Kids with baggies in their pocket. Is there any remorse?
They're officially breaking the law, Dean, but what's going on is this policy is giving 13-year-olds a job option to work as a drug dealer, which gets them killed every day. I'm about to head to Cincinnati, Ohio tomorrow, where last week a 13-year-old boy was cut down with gunfire. They're still doing the investigation, but probably it's drug-related, as are most shootings in this country and many of the homicides. So, the policy supposedly to protect our children gets a lot of them killed or sucked into a life of crime.
Now, our good friend, Judge James P. Gray, he's a Superior Court judge out there in, I think it's Orange County.
Right.
He talked about the fact that following the end of alcohol prohibition, that the murder rate went down by approximately 50% in 1 year.
Right. You can look at the graphs. And we know, and from my professional experience, which it does help. I was on a radio program in Cincinnati earlier today, and when I talk about being a detective and arresting people for breaking into houses because they needed money for crack, it does add credibility to the speaker, and people are more likely to listen. When I say we're a mosquito in the butt of an elephant, after 36 years, this incredible effort being a complete and disastrous failure, people are more inclined to listen. And America knows, without even being told, Dean, that this policy is not working. Everybody, when I rode my horse across America last year, agreed it ain't working.
Due to a technical glitch, I lost a little bit of the recording, but Howard rode his horse Misty across America last year for the second time, generating publicity in hundreds of news outlets proclaiming cops say legalized drugs. Ask me why.
The word is that very few people have made this trek across America. You did it twice. I think people need to realize that there are those who are committed to unveiling this truth, who are willing to go to extreme measures to do so. And I want to speak on behalf of many of my listeners that we thank you for that effort.
Well, you're welcome, Dean. And cops go out there to protect and serve. We want to make a difference. We want to save lives and protect people. And I don't have that badge and a gun anymore, but I with my horse, We were able to raise so much awareness for the issue to help move this, help move the laws forward and begin to think of this as a medical issue. So, you know, a lot of guys dedicated to that because we like the idea of protecting and serving our community. And now as in retirement, we do it, with our mouths as opposed to, you know, arresting people.
Well, week in, week out, I use my mouth here on this radio network. And I proclaim that if we want to get rid of the terrorists, the gangs, the criminals, and just the widespread abuses that occur when law enforcement goes corrupt or just goes a bit too wild, it's nice to have you guys backing me up. I want to thank LEAP for their efforts.
Well, on their behalf, I accept your thanks, and we appreciate what you do. You know, the one thing that's true today on this issue, and essentially nobody disagrees with the premise that it does fund terrorism, causes 75% of felony crime. It gets to join gangs. That the explosion of gangs across America is a direct result of drug prohibition, and we are focusing on Willie Nelson instead of a drunk driver. And of course, at $70 billion we're spending this year, local, state, federal, everybody understands that is a horrendous waste of precious tax dollars. And so even this, no matter how much the right wingers on Capitol Hill, they nobody disagrees with the five premises that prohibition is a complete disaster.
Now, Howard, I know in my case, it was a young man, 17 years old, facing a prison sentence in Texas in the year 1970. Mm-hmm. Who blew his brains out. That is the clanging of the bell. That is one of the original reasons, certainly,
right,
that got me into drug reform. What perhaps motivated you to get involved?
Well, my previous issue was overpopulation, and a gentleman in Dallas was able to recruit me off a letter to the editor based on the kind of a convergence of the two issues. A 14-year-old died of a heroin overdose. One of 11 children, and Bob was able to call me up, and an hour later he had me hooked into the reform movement, so I've been here now 9 years.
Well, Howard, I know that the listeners out there, probably each and every one of them, has a reason that they should get involved, that they should get on board in trying to end this folly, 92 years of drug war. What is your website for law enforcement?
Yes, www.leap.cc. And Dean, I should tell you that you know, this has always been a cause of mine for 9 years, but I've got to tell you on a very sad note that this has become personal. I've never needed medical marijuana. I've never needed any that sort of thing. But Misty is having a problem with some arthritis. And you know, horses, you can't give them basically aspirin all the time because it'll chew up their stomach, just like it will a human being. And I know from my history that marijuana used to be used by horses and other livestock, and today it's very deeply disturbing to me that my horse cannot get this God's medicine because of it being illegal for humans. Of course, it's also illegal for horses. So one of the things I'm now fighting for is not simply my own horse, but all the horse owners out there who may have a horse that needs the painkiller of marijuana, of cannabis, but can't get it because of the prohibition. So I'm also fighting now for all the horse and animal lovers out there who could use God's medicine, perhaps.
It's just obscene that these medicines, you know, which haven't killed anybody, man or beast, are still prohibited, and the government hires these goons to tour the country saying it's an ineffective medicine.
Oh, yeah, Dean. You know, one of the more effective arguments I have when I talk to these staffers is I say, look, marijuana is like somebody's breaking into your house. I give them the analogy. Someone's breaking into your house. You call 911. I'm responding to your house because it could be life or death. I see someone needs a parking ticket that got an expired meter. And so do you want me to stop and write the ticket, or should I continue to your house at 100 miles an hour to save your life? And then so the answer is obvious. I said, look, marijuana is like me stopping to write a parking ticket while you're being hurt or killed or raped by some bad guy. For God's sakes, the first thing you do is get cannabis, marijuana prohibition out of the hair of law enforcement. This is a parking ticket compared to murder in progress, for God's sakes. We got people flying airplanes into buildings, and my federal colleagues are busting up medical marijuana gardens. Who's in charge of this hospital? And Dean, I've talked about 80 staffers, 80 congressional offices, and they all look at me like, yeah, you got a good point. But from there, they just sit on their hands and do nothing because of the power of the pharmaceutical companies to protect their big profits, in my opinion.
No, you're absolutely right. The, you know, LEAP tries to get members of the DEA or law enforcement to debate. I know that many drug reform organizations have done the same as I do, and I'm doing this week contacting the Drug Czar's office to do just that, to see if 50 stations is enough to warrant their attention. Your thoughts, sir? We cannot get these drug warriors to defend their policy, can we?
No, you can't, because it's what they're going to talk about is, well, it's, we're winning. You know, we got drug use is down by 50% over the last 20 years. Of course, it has nothing to do with law enforcement. It has all to do with better education, et cetera. But they're clinging to their $70 billion in paychecks. They're clinging to the influence of the pharmaceutical companies who, you know, we have the best Congress money can buy. And, of course, these people and these companies invest in congressmen, expecting to keep marijuana off the shelf as a competitive product. And they're being, quite, of course, quite successful. It's only the will of the people that is now changing the laws across America. It is disgusting, but that's politics as usual. And now, of course, I live and work in the belly of the beast here in Washington, D.C., but this is the best place to drive a stake through the heart of that beast.
Let's tell the folks a little bit about your day in Washington, D.C. How do you go about business?
Well, I'm a day or so at home setting up appointments. I usually do about 9 in a day. And then I take the train in and then walk over past the Supreme Court building and the Capitol over to the three buildings that house the congressmen, the Rayburn, the Longworth, and Cannon. I sit down with staffers usually. They give me about 15 minutes, sometimes longer, at 30 minutes. And I put out the major points of what would happen when we end drug prohibition, which points out, you know, how it funds terrorism, et cetera. And then I talk about, you know, what can we do in 2006? And I say, pass the same law Texas did in '03, and that is treatment versus incarceration for personal amounts. Been pushing with some success has been the idea of an arrest-free 911 call if someone is dying of an alcohol or drug overdose. The life of the 19-year-old kid being a million times more important than having a guy like me arrest the drug supply. So, again, demonstrating I'm trying to save lives, I'm trying to make America better, and I've had some real good responses, especially to the idea of an arrest-free 911 call, because I am pro-life on this particular issue.
We've been speaking with former police officer Howard Wooldridge, one of the founding members of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. That website, leap.cc. Any closing thoughts, Howard?
Oh, it's very important to keep an email coming to your state senator, your state rep, and your congressman about every 6 months saying, make this a medical issue. Let law enforcement get back to chasing bad guys, the drunk drivers, child molesters, people flying airplanes into buildings. I suggest putting it in public safety terms. Stop funding terrorism. Those are the two biggest things I have gained traction on in this town, is talking about stop people, you know, focus on bad guys. That's the number one issue in America today is security. Policy feeds the terrorists. So mention that in your emails to the politicians. And in fact, every day we learn more and more people are coming to our side. It's still going to take 10 years, but we need to push every year.
I want to thank Howard Wooldridge for joining us here on Cultural Baggage. Again, his website, leap.cc. And if you want to get in touch with your congressman, you can call them toll-free at 1-800-985-8762. That's 1-800-985-8762. We'll be back in just a moment with our interview with Peter Crist.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Depression, delusions, hallucinations, paranoid fears, clinical depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, tardive dyskinesia, and psychosis. Time's up. The answer? Ritalin. Another FDA-approved product.
Basically, the idea is to change political consciousness in this country so that our children, hopefully our children and certainly our grandchildren, look back on the drug wars of the last few decades and of today with the same sort of distaste and contempt and even horror that we look back today on the Jim Crow laws and the slavery in our own nation's history.
Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director, Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org.
You are listening to Cultural Baggage on the Drug Truth Network, and if you get the chance, tune in to our Century of Lies program for this week for law enforcement against prohibition. And I'm proud to have one of the founders of LEAP here with us today, Mr. Peter Crisp. You know, there's no one in government within the medical industry willing to debate you guys in an open public venue, is there?
Well, we haven't. In fact, I just got a small classroom debate coming up at Buffalo State College with some professor down there. I have no idea what he thinks we're going to be debating, but on the other hand, it's been very difficult to get anybody to debate us on this. When they hear that you want to talk about drug legalization, they're very anxious to debate you. And then when they hear that they got to talk to their peers about drug legalization and that we're not going to be talking about the benefits of drugs, but in fact the harmfulness of drugs and the need for them to be regulated and controlled and the fact that prohibition doesn't work, that's where we get the cancellations.
How do you guys present your facts to an audience?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if you have seen our T-shirts. And on the back of it, it has big black letters that said, "Cops say legalize drugs, ask me why." And when I get asked why at an airport or on the road someplace and somebody asks me why, the first thing I say to them is, let's see if we agree about one thing. And that is, I believe that all these drugs, heroin, crack cocaine, marijuana, LSD, all of them, have so much potential to do harm to individuals and then likewise to society that they must be regulated and controlled. Well, when they hear that from me, they always agree with me, of course. Nobody thinks they should be unregulated and uncontrolled. And then I point out to them the problem with our current policy. And that is, when you institute a blanket prohibition, when you just prohibit something, you give up all your ability to regulate and control it. LEAP believes that a regulated and controlled drug marketplace, no matter what it is, and that could be from Schedule II prescription drugs all the way to over-the-counter sales and anything in between, a regulated and controlled marketplace is safer for society, defunds the gangsters who are now running that marketplace. And that's what we've done. We knew in 1933, just like we knew in 1919, that alcohol was very dangerous. But what we realized in 13 short years was that, as dangerous as alcohol was, letting people like Al Capone control that marketplace did not make the problem better, but in fact added new problems that didn't even exist before. Gangsters, a whole distribution marketplace, smuggling, and stuff like that on the part of the gangsters. So what we did was we decided to take that marketplace away from the gangsters and put it in a regulated and controlled marketplace. That did not eliminate our alcohol problem. We still had to deal with our alcohol problem, but we chose as a society to deal with it as a health care and an educational problem instead of a criminal justice problem. And that also doesn't relieve anybody who harms somebody else's property or somebody else from the reach of the law. We still deal with those problems, but that's a small problem compared to the problem we dealt with before. And LEAP believes that legalizing our drug marketplace will have the same effects on our society. It'll defund the gangsters, and in this day and time, it'll also defund the terrorists.
You're up around 500 members of law enforcement or government officials.
Yep.
Who have now joined up with you.
Total membership's about five, creeping up on 5,000, with about 500 of those being professionals from the law enforcement community and the rest being friends of LEAP. LEAP.cc is the website. If anybody wants to see the video we're talking about, and they can see it at our website, and they can also contact us. We provide speakers for, I've spoken to over 1,000 Rotary clubs, Kiwanis clubs, Lions clubs over the years that I've been involved in this issue, and we have other speakers out there scattered throughout the country.
Once again, I want to recommend that you visit our website, which is drugtruth.net. And there you can link up to the LEAP video. It's something you can share with your friends who think the drug war is a good thing.
And now another black perspective on the drug war. Homelessness is a serious problem all across America. In Houston, America's fourth largest city, there are fewer than 3,000 public housing units, while tens of thousands of Houstonians must sleep on the streets, in the parks, or wherever they can find, like so many stray dogs. Ask the politicians why they don't build more affordable housing, and they'll tell you there's no money. It's just too expensive. But wait. Thanks to the drug war, tax money for new accommodations is flowing freely. And what accommodations! $70,000 each, with an additional $25,000 a year set aside for services, maintenance, and board. And there are 1,725 of these units being built each week. Now, normally, being a young black male would be a disadvantage in the competition for housing, but studies have shown that, all else being equal, a young black man is 48 times as likely as his white counterpart to get into one. And applying couldn't be easier. Just go on down to your local police station. If you don't know where it is, don't worry. They'll come to you. No credit, no down payment, no problem. If you have even a minute amount of pot, pills, or powder, you're pre-approved. Even though money for college is drying up, and business loans are few and far between, thanks to the prison industrial complex and the war on drugs, you never have to worry about finding a place to stay. Ain't it a shame? For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
From British Columbia, this is Phil Smith of the Drug War Chronicle with this week's Corrupt Cop story for the Drug Truth Network. This week, we return to Topeka, Kansas, where fallout from corruption in the police department's troubled narcotics unit continues. In September, former Topeka narc Thomas Fort Miller was sentenced to months in prison for stealing thousands of dollars in drug buy money in a case that revealed festering corruption in the drug squad. A month later, Shawnee County District Attorney Robert Hecht reported the drug squad officers routinely tampered with evidence and falsified records, and he demanded that the narcs be regularly rotated out of the unit in an effort to reduce corruption. The police and their union disagreed. This week, Prosecutor Hecht announced that he will no longer use reports from three of the eight officers in the unit, all of whom had put in more than 5 years on the drug squad. That means the cases they developed will not be prosecuted, and so the corruption scandal lingers in Topeka. As always, there are more corrupt cop stories. Check them out online at www.stopthedrugwar.org.
John Tierney of the New York Times wrote quite an article this week. I want to read part of it to you. Just doing his job. After I wrote last year about Richard Paye, the wheelchair-bound patient who's been in physical agony for 2 decades, a lot of readers asked me what kind of monster could have prosecuted him for obtaining painkillers. If you watched 60 Minutes this past week, you could see for yourself. Scott Andringa, the prosecutor in Florida who sent Paye to prison for 25 years, did not come off well on 60 Minutes, but he didn't look dementedly evil either. He seemed exactly the way I found him in interviews, earnest, conscientious, convinced that he's done the right thing. That's why he scares me. He's one of many well-meaning public officials whose judgment has been so warped by the war on drugs that they can't see what they've become. Andringa, echoing the line of the Drug Enforcement Administration, has assured me he would never stop patients from getting medicine for their pain. Quote, "I have the utmost respect for doctors who try to treat pain humanely and responsibly," end quote, he told me. Quote, "I am not a doctor. I have never claimed to be a doctor," end quote. Yet there he was, playing a doctor on 60 Minutes to explain why it was reasonable to infer that Paye was a drug dealer. There was no evidence that Paye had sold any of his painkillers, and agents had conducted surveillance of him and his wife for 2 months. But Andringa inferred that Paye must have been selling them because the prescriptions he received worked out to about 25 pills a day. Quote, "One pill every hour, every day, for 2 years," end quote, Andringa told Morley Safer, as if this feat of math proved his case. It's the same mystic numerology you hear over and over from drug warriors like Karen Tandy, the head of the DEA, who prefers to focus on the number of pills prescribed without bothering with details like the patient's need or the dosage. Paye had no trouble explaining to me why he was taking 25 pills per day. His doctor cautiously gave him a variety of low-strength pills in order to avoid prescribing the kind of painkillers that tempt drug abusers and invite investigations from the DEA. Instead of taking a few high-strength oxycodone pills, Paye took a cocktail of pills containing low doses of oxycodone and other less effective painkillers like Tylenol. As a result, the daily dose of oxycodone in all these pills Paye took was less than what he would have gotten in a single high-strength OxyContin pill. Paye told me he was offered a deal by investigators. They said if you're willing to testify against your doctor, it would go a long way to having these charges go away. Pei refused and then found himself facing hostile testimony from the doctor who said he had not authorized the contested prescriptions. Andrangia told the jurors that even if they believed the doctor had prescribed the drugs, Pei should still be convicted because the doctor should never have written the prescriptions. By this logic, instead of listening to his doctor, Pei should have tried to anticipate what a prosecutor would prescribe for him. I spoke to Andrangia yesterday after he'd watched 60 Minutes. Quote, I'm not thrilled about this case, end quote, he said. Quote, I'm only proud that I did my job as a prosecutor, end quote. And self-appointed doctor. Thank you, Mr. Tierney. And speaking of painkillers...
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
This week, $10 billion was pledged by Western politicians to aid Afghanistan over the next 5 years. Afghan drug czar Habibullah Kadari had asked for $2.1 billion for funding his country's nascent counter-narcotics efforts, but was awarded only $77 million, one trivial 27th of the money requested. The U.S. invasion in 2001 ended the Taliban prohibition against opium production. As a result, under U.S. occupation, Afghanistan now produces almost 7 times more opium than the rest of the world combined. Throughout the Western world, black market heroin, 90% of which originates in Afghanistan, is more available at lower cost and higher purity than ever before. In other news, plans have been announced to withdraw 2,500 American troops from Afghanistan. However, NATO will increase its Afghan deployment by 6,000, including 3,500 more British troops who are to be deployed, ominously, near Afghanistan's border with Iran. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Karen Tandy, the grand czarina of all medical practitioners and the DEA, refuses to come on this show. Because she and all drug warriors are cowards, we bring you these reports from Winston Francis.
No lectures or sermons today. Just a quick thank you to all Americans. Over the past 90 years, you have voted overwhelmingly to empower the government to continue to fight the drug war. The drug warriors can do what they do only because you demand it. If you didn't, they would have heard from you by now. The government does what the voice of the majority says. That's democracy. That's freedom. So here's the 90 more years of you getting exactly what you asked for.
Let freedom ring.
Let freedom ring. This is what you want.
Let the whole world know that today.
Piss in this cup, boy. Suffer and learn. Oh yeah. 90 more years. Let the guilty pay. On behalf of the DEA, all the drug warriors, and all of the piss testers, thank you, America. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
Well, that's about it. I hope you'll join us next week on Cultural Baggage. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of cannabis.